Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Donald Trump's nomination of David Friedman, his bankruptcy attorney who has no diplomatic experience, to be the U.S. ambassador to Israel, and speak with Gideon Levy, an Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz and a member of the newspaper's editorial board. He's the author of The Punishment of Gaza, and we will discuss the choice of a hardline pro-settler opponent of the two-state solution who wants to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, where he maintains a residence. We will also examine whether this radical right-wing Zionist who calls liberal American Jews capos, a reference to those Jews who helped the Nazis during the Holocaust, will be a divisive figure in the American Jewish community and undermine the bipartisan consensus on Capitol Hill for support of Israel. Then we will speak with Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as a counsel to Andrei Sakharov and other activists in the former Soviet Union, and we will discuss President Obama's criticism of Republicans who support Putin that would, quote, make Ronald Reagan roll over in his grave, and why the American left is so blind to who Putin is when, if he were placed in an American political context, would be a right-wing capitalist kleptocrat and thug who persecutes gays, encourages vigilantism, and supports reactionary Christian fundamentalism. Then finally, we'll look into comparisons between how left-wing populism has wrecked oil-rich Venezuela and how right-wing populism fanned by Donald Trump's administration could wreck America, starting with the American government, since Trump has deliberately installed members of his cabinet who are hostile to the mission of the government departments they will oversee. An expert on Venezuela, David Smildy, a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America and professor of sociology at Tulane University, who moderates the blog Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights, joins us. And joining us now from Israel is Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz and a member of the newspaper's editorial board. He's the former spokesman for Shimon Peres, and Gideon Levy writes the weekly Twilight Zone feature, which covers the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza for over the last 25 years. His latest book is The Punishment of Gaza. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gideon Levy.
Thank you so much.
And what do you make of the choice of David Friedman, who is Donald Trump's bankruptcy attorney? He has no diplomatic experience. He is already indicated through his statements at in addressing audiences. He calls liberal Jews capos. He wants to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, and he's very much a hardline pro-settler opponent of the two-state solution.
I would really like to believe that President-elect Donald Trump didn't give a thought to this nomination. I would really like to believe that the Senate will avoid this nomination, because this man will be a persona non grata in Israel, someone who supports illegal settlements and even financed them. One settlement which is almost all of it built on stolen private lands. He is the president of their friendship association, the settlement of Bet El. Someone who speaks about leftist, Zionist organization like J Street in terms of that they are worse than Nazis, worse than capos. This is someone that should not represent the United States, even though the United States of Donald Trump. And above all, someone who doesn't believe in a two-state solution believes, in other words, in Israel as an apartheid state. Someone like him is really not welcome in Israel.
Well, clearly he will have the effect, I think, of being a very divisive figure in the American Jewish community, two-thirds of which, or to three-quarters of which, vote for Obama and Hillary Clinton. And he also, I think, will clearly undermine the bipartisan consensus on Capitol Hill for support of Israel. But when you say he will be person non grata in Israel, with Netanyahu and his government, in charge of the country. Why do you say that?
No, when I say persona non grata in Israel, I mean for circles like my circles, for people who are looking for justice and peace in this part of the world. For the apartheid supporters, he will be more than welcome. But I wonder if the United States, even Donald Trump's United States, is really willing to support the establishment of an apartheid state, the officially apartheid state, because if there is no two-state solution, there is only a one-state solution, and according to right-wingers like Mr. Friedman, who don't appreciate and don't recognize the Palestinians as legitimate human beings who have no rights. So in this case, people like him support an apartheid state. Do really the United States of America support an apartheid state in the 21st century? I have doubts about it.
Well, it's from what I understand that Donald Trump's son-in-law has a lot of influence, Jared Kushner, who's married to his daughter, Ivanka. He apparently has quite a bit of influence in this administration. And in turn, I believe that that Sheldon Adelson, the casino magnate, who's given a lot of money to the Republicans, has also been influential, along with the Mercer family, who are the hedge fund family that are the biggest donors to Donald Trump's campaign. That sort of phalanx, if you will, of pro-Israel, right-wing American Jews apparently is not only have they persuaded, I don't know whether, I think Trump made this decision on his own, but they certainly support the decision. But they've also apparently foisted on the State Department, John Bolton, the neocon. So that's going to be a very, very contested hearing in the Senate, I imagine. And I imagine also the nomination of this ambassador to Israel will also be contested in the Senate. Since you're in Israel, Gideon Levy, and Sheldon Adelson has had a profound effect on Israeli politics, I understand, by creating the most popular newspaper, which he gives away free, which obviously makes life difficult for you and Haaretz. He's a big player in these decisions, from what we can tell.
Absolutely, I agree to everything that you said, and still, one should remember that there is also somewhere a voice of logic. And I think that it's one thing to support all these those things as a private citizen, and it's a different, totally different reality when you do it from the White House, because supporting policy of apartheid will face some resistance all over the world, in Europe, in the Arab world, obviously, but also in Western Europe, with the best allies of the United States. I'm not sure that this will serve any kind of interests of the United States, and I think that once those people will be more responsible to what they say, they will have to reconsider those positions. Don't forget also that all those names you just mentioned, Mr. Kushner, Mr. Adelson, and Mr. Friedman, they don't represent the majority of the Jewish community in the United States. On the contrary, the majority of the Jewish community in the United States is much more liberal and moderate and logical. So time will show who will really take it.
And again, I'm speaking with Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz and a member of the newspaper's editorial board. He's the former spokesman for Shimon Peres and writes the weekly Twilight Zone feature, which covers the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza for over the last 25 years. And his latest book is The Punishment of Gaza. So are you suggesting then, Gideon, that just as both Bill Clinton and George W. Bush campaigned on the idea of moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, and then when they got into office, they were quickly disabused of that campaign promise. Do you think you can abuse David Friedman of something that he feels so strongly about. He has a residence in Jerusalem as well, so he spends a lot of time there.
With all due respect, not Ambassador Friedman will decide where will be his embassy, but President Trump, he's going to decide it. And, you know, he will have to make his considerations. Is he willing to face many, many questions? Like, for example, does it mean that the United States is recognizing not only West Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, but also occupied East Jerusalem? And what will he tell to the Arab world and to the entire Muslim world, who will never recognize Israeli sovereignty over the Temple Mountain, Israeli sovereignty over the holy places for the Muslim world? So all those questions, someone will have to face them. It's very easy to promise to move the embassy to Jerusalem, but one has to take into account also the consequences. And the consequences might be much more serious than they imagine.
Well, it's difficult to know what kind of policies we're going to have in terms of foreign policy, because the State Department, assuming that both the head of Exxon, Rex Tillerson, is confirmed as the U.S. Secretary of State, and John Bolton is confirmed as his deputy. Tillerson, because he's an oil man, probably has had dealings with the Saudis, and he certainly has a lot of dealings with the Russians, and may be more pragmatic. But Bolton is an ideologue who also feels that the embassy should be moved. The problem we have with Donald Trump is that in the face of any criticism, rather than bend to the logic, he doubles down. For example, the more evidence comes out about Putin's role in helping elect him and hurting Hillary Clinton, rather than accept the consensus of the intelligence community, he keeps questioning it. And, that's obviously we're heading for a head-on collision in that regard.
Yeah, and therefore nobody can be relaxed now. I'm not sure that Donald Trump by himself decided already what does he want and where does he go to. Anyone knows that things that you see from one place, you don't see from another place. So in other words, where you stand depends on where you sit. And Donald Trump does not sit yet in the White House, and maybe when he will sit finally in the White House, he will stand in different places, and maybe not, and then we will face quite dramatic developments. Nobody can foresee how will it end. Will he really move the embassy? This is one question, but it's not the most major question, because after this will appear other questions. Will he recognize the settlement project, which contradicts international law? Is he ready to stand in front of the entire international community? Not one single state in the world recognizes the settlement project. Not one single country in the world legitimizes this criminal project. Will the United States of America stand against the whole world? Let's wait and see.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Gideon Levy, with the fall of Aleppo happening at any moment now, and we've seen the hideous toll on civilian life, it's absolutely barbaric what's been going on, and not just in Aleppo, but in the entire civil war. But it looks like Assad will be triumphant with the help of Russia and the Iranians. And if you look at the map, it's not hard to see that the very thing that the Saudis were afraid of, the so-called Shia Crescent, is happening, if not already happened, where Iran, through its proxies, now controls Iraq, will control Syria, and already controls Lebanon to a degree through Hezbollah, its proxy. So is anybody in the Israeli press having second thoughts about Netanyahu and company supporting the neocons who brought about this catastrophe by the Iraq war, the Bush-Cheney Iraq war, which has done nothing but reward Iran and strengthen Iran. And now they essentially have their reach all the way from Iran through to the Mediterranean, echoes of Emperor Darius. As a major geopolitical shift is underway, and Netanyahu recently mentioned how Israel is now, in effect, has Sunni Arab allies like Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia. Is there a discussion about this, the consequences of this major geopolitical shift?
Unfortunately, not. Israel is quite indifferent to what's going on just around the corner. Syria is, a few hours away from any place in Israel. And there is no public discussion, and most of the people know too little about what's going on there and who are the bad ones and who are the good ones. But in any case, I would rather expect Israel not to remain so indifferent also morally and open its borders for refugees like any civilized country should do now facing this terrible, terrible tragedy. And the fact that Israel is closing its border should remind us Israelis and Jews other times in which Europe closed its borders to Jewish refugees. We didn't accept it then. And it's unbelievable how we accept it now that Israel is not letting any refugees into Israel and not taking part in any kind of humanitarian rescue team or rescue project to try to save those tens of thousands of innocent civilians who are the victims of all this crazy, crazy war.
Well, Gideon Levy, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz and a member of the newspaper's editorial board. He's the former spokesperson for Shimon Peres and writes the weekly Twilight Zone feature, which covers the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza for over the last 25 years. And his latest book is The Punishment of Gaza. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into President Obama's criticism of Republicans who support Putin that would, quote, make Ronald Reagan roll over his grave, and why the American left is so blind to who Putin is. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, and serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton. Scott, are you there?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you, yes. So what do you make of what the president said in his last press conference, particularly in relation to how I think about a third of Republicans, even more Republicans, are very supportive of Vladimir Putin, and Obama made the quip that this would make Ronald Reagan turn over in his grave?
Well, he's certainly correct about that. I mean, I think Ronald Reagan coming back today would be completely shocked not only at the Republican leadership, but also at the changing attitudes of the party. And I think we've seen a number of public opinion polls rolled out in the course of the last 2 weeks that show a very dramatic shift in attitudes within the Republican Party about Russia and about Vladimir Putin, which can be tied directly to the influence of the party's leader, Donald Trump, and the policies he's preparing to put in place after January 20th, which amount to a 180-degree shift from the current government policies with respect to Russia. They amount to a broad strategic alliance with Russia in many, many different areas. But, of course, we haven't yet seen many of the details of this emerge.
So the other poll that came out that's equally extraordinary, it finds that the majority of Republicans, 52%, believe that Donald Trump won the popular vote. And it's pretty clear that Hillary Clinton won at least 2.8 million. And by the time all the votes are counted, it could be as high as 3 million. So I'm astounded by that. And what concerns me is that with Stephen Bannon as his propagandist, who clearly knows he's very clever. He was the guy that used Facebook to great advantage and helped win the election for Trump. It's as though the Trump administration, because Trump goes out on the stump all the time and says, I had this fabulous victory, which is probably why so many Republicans think he won the popular vote as well as the Electoral College, which, by the way, votes tomorrow. It's just almost as if they are borrowing from Putin's playbook, because Putin's got the whole country of Russia completely beguiled in fake news. And by the way, Putin has made it clear, and Russian television has made it clear, or Russian media, I should say, has made it clear that unlike what normally happens in the intelligence world where you don't take credit for things, particularly hacking, Putin is pretty much taking credit for putting Donald Trump in the White House. And the Russian people are thrilled that Putin has pulled off this coup. And Putin's ratings have gone up from 80% to 86%.
All that's absolutely true. I mean, in fact, it's I follow news and press reports in Russia very closely. In fact, I particularly read what's published about foreign relations and economics. I follow their coverage of the American election very closely, and there was never really any attempt to suggest that they weren't involved in influencing the American election. To the contrary, it was pretty loudly proclaimed, and when the election results came out, there were celebrations. There was spontaneous standing ovation on the floor of the State Duma, for instance. There were Russian cities that held celebrations on the streets and awarded the city's honors to Donald Trump, who was viewed as our candidate, quite obviously. And even with respect to the specific allegations of hacking, for instance, there would be what I would call non-denial denials issued by officials of the government. So they would say, well, no, you know, we don't admit to our covert operations. But it was always accompanied by wink, wink, nod, nod. Yes, of course we did this. And we're very proud of the results that were obtained. So I think in the entire world, the only place we see denial of what's happened is, you know, in some corners. Well, I think I think Trump's own people deny it, and then they're joined by some people on the left in the United States. I think people like Glenn Greenwald and a handful of others also criticize, saying essentially you can't prove it. Now, of course, that's also the official claim of Putin has been pretty much you can't prove it.
Well, that's a pretty low bar, isn't it? Given, first of all, the intelligence community has come out with a consensus now, not just on the facts that the Russians hacked the election, but also on the real issue of intent, whether Putin intended to elect Donald Trump. And now even the FBI has joined in that consensus. So the evidence, of course, on intent hasn't been released. And Ryan Priebus again today pointed that out. But obviously, all these people have to do is get a briefing. I mean, anybody that's been briefed apparently gets the message. And the puzzling part is, why did Barack Obama not put this out earlier? Apparently, they made a statement back at the time that coincided with the release of the Access Hollywood tape, which obviously sucked the oxygen out of that release. But it's pretty mystifying why Obama, who campaigned for Hillary Clinton, wasn't more vocal about the Russian hacking when it mattered.
I agree with that. I mean, I go back and say that, you know, the information showing hacking and the conclusion of hacking is not just in the United States. So the German intelligence community, the BND, came to that conclusion in the course of the election. The French intelligence came to that conclusion. MI6 in the UK seems to have been one of the principal sources of evidence and information. So it was pretty much the entire alliance system in the United States that was flashing red lights about this all along the way. And indeed, if you read the commentaries that appeared in European media, what you hear is very sharp criticism directed towards Barack Obama. And the criticism is that exactly what you suggest, he didn't act on this. You know, there was a briefing that was done for congressional leaders. I think they went a little bit beyond the Gang of Eight, but it wasn't a large group, maybe 10 or 12 people total. And there was a pitch made in that briefing to get everybody to agree. And evidently, Mitch McConnell said no. And so that was the end of it. There was no further action taken. And, you know, there have been editorials published, for instance, in Die Zeit in Germany, castigating Obama over that, saying that was simply irresponsible. He had a duty to bring all this out to the American public and provide a detailed briefing about what was going on what the objective of the Russians was. He had a duty to do that back when this was first discovered in September and not sit on it until a month after the election and then allow it to come out.
And again, I'm speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and is a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He served as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Bonner, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, and serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. And Scott, you mentioned earlier that Glenn Greenwald of The Intercept has been, in effect, an apologist for Putin. Also, the editor of The Nation, Katrina Vandenhoevel, and her husband, Stephen Cohen, they've gone as far to suggest that people in the press who look into the Russian Putin-Trump angle are resorting to or practicing a form of McCarthyism. Why is it that the American left is so blind to who Putin is, when if he were placed in an American political context, would be a right-wing capitalist kleptocrat and thug who persecutes gays, encourages vigilantism, and supports reactionary Christian fundamentalism?
Well, let me just say, first of all, I'm a senior fellow of the Nation Institute, and I would say those views are the views of Stephen Cohen and his wife and a few others. They're also a small minority view even within the Nation, the publication, that is, small minority position, but a loud voice nevertheless. No, I think, in fact, the attitudes of the Putin administration, like those of Trump, are their hard right. And they have been virulent in the way they have abused and mistreated others across the political spectrum. In fact, he has acted with absolute brutality against homosexuals, for instance, and against political opponents of almost all stripes. He's had a thuggish attitude about religion. Anyone who crosses paths with the religious right in his country, the Russian Orthodox Church, can wind up in prison or beaten. A long, long list of people have been brutally murdered, and brutally murdered in ways in which there is, we were left with no doubt whatsoever that Putin himself was behind the murders. And that includes Boris Nemtsov, a former first deputy prime minister, a friend of mine, Anna Politkovskaya, one of the most important political journalists in the country, Alexander Litvinenko, for instance, a former intelligence officer who became an expose writer in the United Kingdom, and many, many, many other people. Alexander Magnitsky, a lawyer who called out a tax fraud, wound up being murdered in prison. So this is the way that regime operates. And for people to stand up and offer it protection and shelter, to me, is simply shocking. Now, I think they're pushing back because they think all attempts to vilify Russia are only come from warmongers who want to start another Cold War or even something much more aggressive with the Russians. That's actually a propaganda posture that that Putin himself uses all the time. Anytime he's even afraid some criticism is going to come from the West, he has his broadcast services running stories about World War III being just around the corner. And that's ridiculous. In fact, I think if you look at the way Barack Obama has handled this in terms of the military dimension, he's been very, very cautious in the way he's approached things. He's favored economic sanctions rather than any sort of military action. And even in the face of the very aggressive actions that Putin has taken in Ukraine and the seizure of Crimea, there's been no countermeasures that were military in any sense coming from the United States. There's even been reluctance to sell sophisticated weaponry to the Ukrainians. That's been a balanced, cautious position, and it's probably correct. But what we're going to see with Trump is probably a shift to a tactical and military alliance with Russia, an alliance that is going to shock all of our historical partners, starting with the NATO partners.
Well, just in terms of the of this collision course we're on between the intelligence community and the Trump administration, who continue to double down and deny the obvious, that Putin was involved and that he tipped the scales in Trump's favor, along with the head of the FBI, James Comey. And, of course, Hillary Clinton is almost 3 million ahead in the popular vote. So it's pretty clear that without the interference of Comey and Putin, Hillary Clinton would be being inaugurated on January the 20th. And that's something, obviously, that must be very difficult for her to live with. But we're going to be living with Trump for 4 years. And my sense is that the explanation, when you talk about intent, which is what the Glenn Greenwalds and the Nation people, Vanderhoeven and her husband, more or less saying, where's the proof? And Putin keeps saying, where's the proof? Well, in Putin's case, he's always had the best of both worlds. He kills Litvinenko with polonium, which is clearly something you can't get off the shelf, at the same time says, well, my fingerprints weren't on the assassination. He does this all the time. And in fact, the fact that the Russian press is celebrating Putin's great coup, it's as though Putin was so thrilled with his pulling off this great intelligence operation to get his guy in the White House that he simply couldn't. He couldn't contain himself, and normally hacking remains a secret, but in this case, he just had to take credit.
I think that's right. Of course, you know, we're not talking about convicting and sending Vladimir Putin to prison for the murder of Litvinenko. That's not the case. We're saying that he bears responsibility for that death because that death was carried out as a strike organized by Russian intelligence. And indeed, no one else could have had access to polonium. And indeed, as the inquiry in the UK concluded, the individuals who were involved in setting it up were indeed senior officers of the State Intelligence Services. So there's just no question of his accountability and responsibility. Same thing for Politkovskaya, same thing for Nemtsov, and many other cases. And, you know, the big question is, why do we want to have an alliance with someone who behaves like this? And why do we want to stiff our historical allies, starting with the United Kingdom, France, Germany, and so forth. And all those countries, by the way, are also looking at the same sort of tactics being practiced. I mean, we just had elections 2 weekends ago in Austria, and, you know, the German intelligence service found that almost, they had a list, in fact, in Süddeutsche Zeitung listing seven characteristics of Putin's engagement with the U.S. elections. All those same characteristics were true in Austria as well, you know, down to the fake news bots being operated in Macedonia and Serbia, flooding the internet in Austria with propaganda for the extreme right-wing party, the FPO. And we've seen the same sorts of activities go on in Bulgaria, Moldova, and Hungary, and preparations for the elections in Germany, which are coming up this year, and the elections in France. In fact, the French police raided in February of last year the offices of the Front National in Paris and found evidence of a $14 million loan that was being made by the Kremlin to the FN. And the FN was being asked to make a whole series of commitments in terms of policy to them to get the loan. And those commitments are exactly the same thing that Donald Trump announced in the course of the campaign: recognition of Russian control of Crimea, cessation of criticism of their operations against Ukraine, termination of sanctions.
Well, just in the last minute or so then, Scott Horton, do you think when I mentioned this that we're on a collision course between, or Trump's on a collision course with the intelligence community, what's your sense of how that's going to be resolved? Because Trump has a propensity to double down, and it's so obvious that even with Mitch McConnell accepting that the intelligence community's consensus that Putin tipped the scales for Trump. Do you think he'll ever get behind this or ahead of this by accepting the obvious, or will he continue to double down? And what kind of a relationship is he going to have with the intelligence community if he doesn't want the truth from them?
Well, I think he has an intensely hostile relationship with the intelligence community right now, and that's because the intelligence community has figured out who he is and what he did to get elected. And I think I just put it one step forward. So we have a lot of information out there right now about what the Russians did to influence the election. Now let's assume that all of that was actually solicited by Donald Trump, and that Donald Trump participated in the direction of those efforts and had prior knowledge of things that were being leaked and, in fact, provided direction of the flow of things. I've been given assurance that the intelligence service, in fact, have hard evidence of all those things. And if all that comes out, this is grounds for him to be impeached and removed from office. And so you suggested he would be around for 4 years. I frankly don't think so. If he's around for 1 year, I'll be surprised.
Well, I guess a lot of our listeners probably will say from your lips to God's ears, but I'm not sure that, you know, you have to let this guy fall under his own weight. The people who support him honestly see him as their savior, and they've got to learn the hard way that he's a phony. So I'm not sure.
It will be in the hands of the Republicans in the Senate.
So I see.
He will not be removed unless the majority of the Republicans conclude that he engaged in impeachable offenses. But, you know, I mean, I'm just looking at statements that have been made by Jeff Flake, John McCain, Lindsey Graham, Sasse, about seven or eight Republican senators, and just looking at what they're saying suggests to me they believe that already.
Right.
So you get three times that many Republicans on the same side, and he's going to be removed.
Well, Scott Horton, I thank you very much for joining us.
My great pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves as counsel to Andrei Sakharov and Elena Boller, among other activists in the former Soviet Union, and serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into, as the left-wing populism ruins Venezuela, will right-wing populism under Donald Trump ruin America?
Heard the song of a poet who died in the gutter. Heard the sound of a clown that cried in the alley. It's a heart, it's a heart, It's a heart, it's a heart, it's a heart rings gonna fall.
Sabana porque está viejo y cansado, pero no se dan de cuenta que un corazón amarrado, cuando le sueltan las riendas es caballo desbocado. Una potra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra, el pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a falseta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran falsas riendas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David Smildy, who's a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, specializing in Venezuela, and a professor of sociology at Tulane University. Professor Smildy has researched Venezuela for the past 25 years and has lived there for a total of 10 years, during which time he's taught at the Universidad Central de Venezuela and the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello. He moderates the blog Venezuela Politics and Human Rights. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Smildy.
Thank you for having me.
And it does seem that Venezuela is going off the rails and that it's a sort of victim of left-wing populism, starting with Hugo Chavez and his successor, who's obviously pales in comparison and has been spectacularly incompetent. I feel like in many ways this country is about to enter an era of right-wing populism, and who knows what the consequences are going to be. But is it fair to say that the wreckage of Venezuela is a result of left-wing populism?
Well, I think it would be fair to say that. I think, there's a couple of different elements there. One is the populism, which, of course, can be right or left. And I think that is probably the most important issue here when comparing to the United States, because what populism does is it tends to create this notion of the people, the real people, versus some sort of conspiring elite. That logic tends to have these leaders concentrate power and violate or undermine liberal institutions. And so that's really what has happened here in Venezuela, in the sense that, Chavez, before Maduro, concentrated power in the executive, promoted this logic of you're either with us or against us, that this is a revolution, you have to be on board. There was no real space for internal criticism. When that happens, a movement like this ends up sort of atrophying and not being able to change course. It doesn't get the feedback that it needs. And so you see some, you know, it's just really incredible policies that the Maduro government has taken. I think, Chavez is the one that really laid down the logic, the sort of social and political logic of this government. And that has put Maduro in office, and that has led Maduro to take a series of economic policies that really are indefensible in terms of any kind of rational economic thought.
Well, the latest is just insane, what's gone on with the pulling the 100 Bolivar notes from circulation. And, of course, people have to shop with vast stacks of banknotes reminiscent of Weimar Germany before the collapse and the arrival of the Nazis. Maduro, again, is, as he always does, is blaming foreigners and implying that it's the Americans again that have sabotaged his campaign to replace these notes, and he's saying that plane loads carrying the new 500, 2,000, and 20,000 Bolivar notes have been blocked and stopped. And I don't know where they're being printed, the notes, but, this is a guy that has his own radio talk show and, plays, I think it's salsa music, doesn't he play? Well, is it like Nero fiddling while Rome is burning?
Well, I think that's exactly the parallel that comes to mind, is Nero playing the fiddle in the fall of Rome. It's hard to understand this measure of demonetizing these 100 Bolivar notes. You know, it's people now thinking back to the time when they could take a garbage bag or a duffel bag full of bills to go buy their they're good seems like the good old days compared to now when nobody's quite sure what the status of these 100 Bolivar notes are. This has caused protests around the country. Of course, they've done this, and the other notes are not actually even in the country yet, so they can't replace them. So basically, you have an economy without cash, and this has caused serious, serious strife. Maduro has called this, has said that this is an international conspiracy. That's his go-to explanation for virtually every failure of governance of his government. I don't think that anybody believes this, but it's, how long is it going to go on is really anybody's guess. I mean, I think, this is a government that actually has a theory that really believes in control, and that really believes that it can control prices, that it can control the price of its currency, that it can control the distribution process, the production process. And so they really thought that they could, in 72 hours, withdraw 70% of the currency and replace it with the new currency, and that this would not cause problems. I mean, this is something that, it's a huge logistic operation. There's 6 billion individual 100 Bolivar bills in the economy, and to think that you could somehow draw this out in 72 hours. Now he's extended the measure, and so we'll see what happens tomorrow, if people can use this currency. But I think, this just adds a new level of crisis and difficult existence to people who are already suffering.
And again, I'm speaking with David Smildy, who's a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, specializing in Venezuela, and a professor of sociology at Tulane University. Professor Smildy has researched Venezuela for the past 25 years and has lived there for a total of 10 years, during which time he taught at the Universidad Central de Venezuela and the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello. He moderates the blog Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights. So I don't know where the plane loads of cash are coming from, where they're printing them for the new Venezuelan currency. But one of the excuses that, or the reasons for this edict to pull all the 100 Bolivar notes in a short period of time, which Maduro has now backed down from, was based upon organized crimes that he wanted to break their back because they've got so much, they've got huge stashes of 100 Bolivar notes. But I mean, I don't know how, if the average person can't get rid of the 100 Bolivar notes, why would organized crime people have, warehouses full of the stuff?
Yeah, it's really inexplicable. I mean, it's hard to imagine why anybody would want to hoard the currency, the least stable currency in the world right now, a currency that's lost 60% of its value in the past 2 months. I mean, it'd be completely irrational to want to hoard that. I do think that there's an issue of counterfeiting, that these bills can be used, can be exported and reused for people that want to make dollars or want to make other kinds of currency. But other than that, it's hard to understand why anybody would hoard it. There is, there are significant operations across the border in Colombia that exchange money. And so, I mean, I think, from their perspective, they really think that something like this is going on, that people are hoarding. They want to sort of burn the hands of money traders. They know that some of this has gone abroad by counterfeit. And in the end, if only two-thirds of these bills are turned back in, if you think of every bill, every currency that's emitted is like a little IOU, and if you can imagine that a third of these are not turned in, well, that's money that's debt that's just wiped off the balance sheet of the central bank. And so that actually helps the government's position in that sense. But the thing is, it's not counterfeiters and hoarders that are being burned by this. It's actually the sort of the most humble people that are the poorest that live in the interior in rural areas that live basically with a cash economy. People in Caracas tend to use electronic deposits and payment. But people, it's affecting the poor, it's affecting the rural, and that's why you see, and you look at the news, all the protests that are breaking out, the most significant protests and looting that are breaking out, are in far-flung rural areas. These are the people that are most affected by this measure.
So, since the wheels have been coming off for some time, I mean, to begin with, it's pretty unconscionable that a country that's as oil-rich as Venezuela could be in this situation. I mean, you really have to go out of your way to ruin an economy that is so oil rich. I mean, I guess it comes down to ideology, it just governing by ideology. It creates this kind of a mess. I mean, I'm with the Pacifica Radio Network, and it's been, its governance has been taken over by ideologues for over a decade now, and they've basically brought the network to the brink of bankruptcy. So I'm it's quite personal in a way, you know, to witness incompetent ideologues wrecking something. I know it's a small pale example compared to the country of Venezuela, but it does feel that that's the problem. And here we are in about to face a Trump administration that in many ways is fired up with right-wing ideology.
Yeah, it's difficult to understand sometimes. I mean, I think, you know, for a long time people thought, well, you know, there's no economic reform because there's stakeholders within the government, people that are benefiting from, you know, these immense distortions in price controls and the price of the currency. And of course that is happening. But, you know, I was talking to a month or so ago with one of the persons that was organizing, that created UNASUR's new economic policy for Maduro, which is a very reasonable economic policy, how they could reorient the economy, how they could recover some of their equilibriums. You know, and Maduro had previously said that they were going to follow this economic policy in UNASUR, you know, down to the last letter. But when it came down to it, it was he and his advisor, Alfredo Serrano, who's a Marxist economist from Spain, who in the end said, well, no, this is going to affect the poor too much. We can, you know, if we get a hold of these things, we can control the prices, and we have this oil money coming in, and we can distribute it in a rational way so that it benefits the most needy. And that's what I think it comes down to, is that this ideology, this perspective, is a perspective that simply doesn't believe in markets. You know, if you believe in markets, you believe that buyers and sellers can set prices themselves, you know, depending on supply and demand. But if you don't believe in that, you know, if you really believe that you have the power to control prices, you have the power to control distribution, well, then you don't really need markets, and this type of thing should work out. When it doesn't, well, you have to come up with an alternative explanation. You look for sabotage and conspiracies, you know, internally and from abroad. And so this is the logic that has been governing Maduro and his advisors. You know, we'll see if Donald Trump repeats this logic. I hope to think that it's not going to be quite as bad as this. I think in other countries, I think even if Chavez, you go back to Chavez, you know, he had a capacity to reorient. He had some sort of understanding of markets. He definitely pushed the government towards socialism and towards much more control, but he still had some sort of appreciation for markets. I don't think Nicolas Maduro really has any understanding of them.
Well, apparently, though, you've just told us, David Smalley, that the victims of this roundup of the currency, which he's backed down on, the 100 Bolivar note, which buys just about nothing. I think it's worth, what, about 8 cents or something ridiculous? What's it worth now?
Yeah, I think more like about 4 cents.
4 cents,
or less.
Yeah. You were saying that this affects the poor more than anything else. So how can you be an advocate for the poor and have policies that hurt the poor?
Yeah, it hurts the poor. You know, that's not necessarily their intention. I mean, I think it hurts the poor most in the end because they're the ones that have the best, you know, do most of their transactions in cash. But I think this government thinks that if they can control, if they have this oil money coming in, these oil dollars coming in, and they can control where they go, and they can import goods, and they can distribute them through their participatory mechanisms, well, then people are going to get what they need. No, but they have this consistent underestimation of the complexity, the logistic complexity of these kind of tasks, and think that they can control every single detail. And, of course, they can't. No, nobody really can. And so, you know, you have all kinds of unintended consequences, you know, all kinds of circumstances and things that get out of your control. And the default explanation then ends up being a conspiracy. And so I do think, you know, if you look at the Chavez period, and it was very clear that poverty and inequality were improved, that people's lot was improved. You know, in the Maduro period, this is completely turned around. You know, and it's actually people in the middle class and upper classes that earn in dollars or are more tied into international commerce that can navigate these situations better. And this is this is just works in that line as well. It's the poor that work in a cash economy that are most affected by this.
Well, again, not to belabor the analogies between left-wing populism being the wrecking crew in Venezuela, and here we're facing the prospect of right-wing populist government, who are very much the wrecking crew in terms of the people that Trump has appointed to his cabinet, or just about all of them violently oppose the very government departments that they're going to be heading up. And Donald Trump has already indicated in many ways that we're going to have government by stunt. The carrier deal was a stunt. The Boeing, calling out Boeing over the new Air Force One was a stunt. Having the Japanese billionaire offer a $50 billion investment and 55,000 jobs was a stunt. And in terms of the analogy with left-wing populism in Venezuela, of course, that's all Maduro does, is I have these stunts, the latest of which was to go and raid toy stores and just confiscate all the toys ahead of Christmas, based upon this idea that these stores were hoarding toys. I mean, again, pure stunts. Do you see an analogy there?
Well, I think the basic mechanism there is to think that, well, you don't need to work through structures and institutions, but rather having one person that works through this identifiable moral economy and just does what everybody thinks is right is somehow going to fix this. And so, Trump threatens carrier air conditioning companies so that they keep jobs in Indiana. The idea that somehow he can be able to do that with every company that's trying to move jobs away, you know, is just absurd. The way you can do that is changing the incentives and changing markets. But, you know, he seems to be oriented towards these sort of heroic individual statements. And, of course, all this always has a lot to do with media. You know? And in that sense, Trump is very similar to Chavismo in that they're very oriented towards media spectacle. You know? And I think that really gets people's attention. There's a lot of people that also don't understand things like institutions and markets. And so they like that, and they see, you know, this is a guy that's doing something that I understand, that I think is right, and that this is what I want somebody to do. And so I think, you know, that media element combines with this sort of personalist, individual attack on institutions, and of course that ends up, you know, I think stunt is the right word for a lot of these measures.
Well, David Smalley, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Okay, thank you for calling.
And again, I've been speaking with David Smalley, who's a senior fellow at the Washington Office of Latin America, specializing in Venezuela. And he's also a professor of sociology at Tulane University and has researched Venezuela for the past 25 years and lived there for a total of 10 years, during which time he taught at the Universidad Central de Venezuela and the Universidad Católica Andrés Bello. He moderates the blog Venezuelan Politics and Human Rights. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.